You're listening to The Recap, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and of course the Monocle Daily. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear from Paris as the skies fill with the latest and greatest in aviation ingenuity.
It's really exciting to be here today with both these aircraft and really to announce that the performance is better than we had predicted. So really rewarding after all the hard work.
We also pour ourselves a drink and wander through Melbourne's labyrinth of laneways filled with trendy bars as we discuss Monocle's quality of life survey.
The bar industry is primarily about spectacle, and people are heading out to enjoy themselves and be separated from day-to-day grind, and a bar is a great place to enjoy that spectacle, and that can include fashion shows and circus performers.
And it's been a long and colourful road for politics on cinema screens. We'll hear about the early days of silent cinema and how they gave way to today's dark cynicism. All that and much more coming up over the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. First up on today's show, we'll look at this week's series featured on The Globalist. On Monday, we took ourselves back in time for a look at the world of silent cinema as the talking age loomed. Anyone who's seen the hit Netflix series House of Cards could be forgiven for completely forgetting any political television before it. Kevin Spacey's devilishly menacing portrayal of a monstrous Washington politico is both horrifying and addictive. But the road to political fiction on our screens has been a long evolution. This week's series looked at the changing face of politics in the cinema and on television, from the propaganda of the silent age to the cynical skepticism as the Nixon era dawned. To start things off, I settled in for a bag of popcorn to discuss the origins of the political genre with film historian Peter Walsh.
Political cinema struggled in the early period because cinema itself was struggling to find legitimacy. It was difficult to communicate a legitimate message politically if your audience viewed your medium as trivial, as a sort of fairground attraction. This didn't stop some people from trying to do political cinema. You have instances of William McKinley, the American president, running in 1896. Favorable portraits were done of him walking around the states. They were effectively portraits of the would-be presidential candidate, and that was seen almost more as a document more than a political message. It was seen as a novelty. And it took maybe until the First World War, until people could view cinema as a legitimate platform for making a political message. And in the run-up to the war and during the war is when you really start to see quite how nations utilized cinema as a political tool to further their geopolitical interests, to justify their geopolitical acts in challenging nations around the world. Britain particularly so, Germany of course as well. And then in the aftermath of the war, you slowly saw British political parties individually starting to engage cinema as a political device for campaigning, basically.
Almost as soon as the talking picture became the norm for audiences, governments began harnessing the power of cinema to push core policies, as this early 1930s American short shows.
Every time we have anything to do with them, we get into trouble. Look at us now. So I say, leave them alone.
But, mister, we've got to do business with them.
Why? We can make the best of everything right here in the USA.
Sure we can, if we have the raw materials to make them from, but we haven't. We have to get lots of them from abroad.
Nonsense. As I said before, you take the American automobile.
You don't know the half of it, Bert.
What's the matter with you? Thought you were asleep.
If you had your way, there wouldn't be any such thing as an American automobile.
Huh. There'll always be an American automobile.
Not if we don't get things from abroad, there won't.
We get lots of raw materials from abroad. Besides, that's the way we get paid for the things that we sell to other countries. by the things they send us. Buying raw materials enables us to sell automobiles.
But while the US was busy pushing homegrown economics, something far more menacing was brewing on another continent.
Und weil dieser beste Rassenwert der deutschen Nation in einer stolzen Selbsteinschätzung.
It surprised a lot of nations quite how effective the Nazis' political propaganda was. Didn't so much set the tone, but it set a standard that this was not a medium that could be ignored. It was a medium that political forces had to engage with. Obviously, in the UK, you have the emergence of documentary makers funded by the government who sought to step out and produce maybe documentaries about the postal service or the military service or the need to rebuild, all sorts of social endeavors. It was used not so much in a way to create a political ideology, but to justify political actions, to justify spending on nationalizing a postal service, on nationalizing a rail service, and providing a public service, and justifying that to an audience who needed to be explained to.
With the talking film now firmly the norm in most markets around the globe, cinema quickly matured into a respected art form. The US government even called upon the Hollywood star machine to push its message, such as this clip of Betty Davis encouraging people to buy up war bonds in the early 1940s.
Ginny, this is for you. And Billy, this is for you. It's Mother's Christmas present.
War bond?
Yes, darling, war bonds.
Well, gee, thanks a lot, Mom, but
I wanted a bicycle.
I know you did, Ginny.
But the most astute political minds soon realized that the simplicity of stating an agenda in front of a camera would no longer cut through all the competing messages.
Newsreels and political biography are effective in communicating one message, but the most effective message you can communicate is one where the politics is inherent in the film. Audiences were drawn to newsreels for the sake of learning news, but they weren't drawn to overtly political stories. They turn a lot of audiences off if there is an obvious grandstanding political message at the heart of the film. It'll interest some audiences, but it will turn other audiences clean off. But the Nazis in particular saw that a soft touch with political messages in basically popular entertaining films was a lot more effective than certain forms of propaganda. It was a lot more subtle, a lot more nuanced, and a lot more effective at conveying a political argument if you could do it while being entertaining.
With the Second World War reaching its end, the need for that certain kind of political propaganda died away. And with the fabulous 50s on the horizon, Hollywood became decidedly more glamorous. Celebrities became gods, the strict studio system lost its grip, and a new age of cinematic politics loomed. For Monocle, I'm Ben Rylan. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. And it was a big week for aviation enthusiasts and indeed the industry as a whole. The world's biggest air show took to the skies over Paris, and we sent Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister to keep an eye on the proceedings. Here he is now on a highlight from the briefing, chatting with Rob Dewar, Vice President and General Manager of the C-Series program at Bombardier Commercial Aircraft.
We've been looking at the C-Series here. You have it here in front of us. We actually have two versions of it, the CS-100, the CS-300. This is a long time coming because for you, you've been with the program for a very long time. You are number one on the program, in fact. That's true, right?
Yeah, actually, I was joined, three of us started at the same time at the very onset of the program. And it was really to understand the market, understand what the customer needs are, and also develop a technology that allows to have a very competitive aircraft.
And how is it for you? Is it emotional for you to see these airplanes on the tarmac in, you know, basically in the flesh and seeing people see them and interact with them?
Yeah, of course. It's very exciting to be here with both models, CS-100 and CS-300. It's incredibly challenging to develop a high-technology product like this. And it's really exciting to be here today with both these aircraft and really to announce that the performance is better than we had predicted. So really rewarding after all the hard work.
And you say better performance, how much better? I mean, what did you think? Was that because it was computer models and then maybe in test flights you actually saw the planes did better? Or
yeah, I'll explain. So basically there's a lot goes into the technology of an aircraft. There's the engines, the aerodynamics, of course all the software and systems. And so in the beginning we set a really stretched goal, which a lot of people were challenging us, is that really possible to do? And certainly our competitors said it wasn't possible. And really just through integrating the technology well and specifically sizing the aircraft for this market segment, we're able to deliver a very competitive product to the market.
That was Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister there, in conversation with Rob Dewar from Bombardier, in a highlight from Monday's edition of The Briefing. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, for all his faults, Mohamed Morsi was the first freely elected president in Egypt. Last month, he was sentenced to death. And earlier this week, a court in Cairo upheld that verdict, as well as imposing, in arguably ironic counterpoint, a life sentence on charges of spying for foreign Islamist groups. It's 2 years since Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood were removed from power in the country, having won power themselves in the first democratic election a year before that. The confirmation of Morsi's death sentence, principally for his role in escaping prison during 2011's uprising, has been condemned as farcical, and yet it certainly underlines the completeness of the reversal of power. Ruth Michelson, Monocle's contributor in Cairo, joined the Monocle Daily on Tuesday for a chat with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
We saw about a month ago, I believe, that the Obama administration, when they were reacting to the initial death sentence, said that they were deeply concerned by it. We're still waiting to see if they might come out with perhaps a harsher statement or something like that, because it's now been confirmed that this is going to happen. In terms of how things feel on the ground, it feels pretty much exactly the same to the reaction that we saw when this sentence initially came out. But I suppose it, you know, remains to be seen what the Brotherhood do and the statements that we hear from them, from the exiled members abroad.
I mean, talk to us a little bit more about the Brotherhood. I mean, the Islamists, any Islamist still brave enough to speak in Egypt, have said that the world should brace itself for a backlash. I mean, what does that mean? And indeed, what power or influence does the Muslim Brotherhood, now condemned as a terrorist organisation, still wield in Cairo and the like?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, Egypt has really gone through the most incredible, brutal crackdown on this group that it's ever seen, really. And this is really focused on going after the top leadership. So, you know, the sentence that we saw for Morsi today, the death sentences that were also given to five other leading members of the Brotherhood. So that's kind of, you know, that's taken away the top layer of the leadership, which means that, you know, and there's also been arrests of, you know, middle-ranking members as well. So if you go and talk to sort of the quiet Brotherhood members that are maybe still doing the odd street protest here in Egypt, they'll say, well, we want, you know, this is a red line. We don't accept that this is happening. But if you ask them, okay, well, are you organizing? What do you intend to do? There doesn't really seem to be a lot happening. And that's because this was a very top-down organization and they're kind of only used to doing business a certain way and they haven't necessarily found a new direction yet.
There is still, if I've read this right, another process of appeal to which Morsi can still go through, and doubtless he will. But once that's gone, and once he's dealt with that, if there is no chance in his sentence, is there actually any meaningful chance that the al-Sisi regime will actually hang him?
Well, this is a good question. I'm sure this is on a lot of people's minds at the moment. I suppose the way to answer this would be to put this in context. Mohamed Badi and some of the other Brotherhood leaders have received multiple death sentences, some of which have also been confirmed. So Morsi is now in the same position. We haven't seen the hanging yet of a high-ranking Brotherhood member in this way. So there was the execution of a man who was accused of being part of the Muslim Brotherhood, who is said to have pushed one off a roof during the June 2013 protest. But it's not actually proven, as I understand it, that this person was a member of the Brotherhood. So to take this to the top level and to start executing the leaders might really inspire more of a backlash than they're willing to deal with. So it seems much more likely that they will sort of keep them bouncing between different parts of the court system and locked in solitary confinement for a prolonged period than they would be willing to go and actually execute people.
Ruth Michelson, Monocle's contributor in Cairo there, in a highlight from the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. You can, of course, catch the latest episode live at 2200 weekdays here in London. That's 7 a.m. if you're in Melbourne. Still to come on the recap, we'll hear about the closure of an iconic Paris bookstore, and the fictional president Frank Underwood inspires us to take a closer look at the current crop of political depictions on our screens.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at McGlory House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here at Midori House on Monocle 24. To accompany the launch of Monocle's long-awaited quality of life survey, out on newsstands now, we thought we'd bring you a countdown of what we think are the five most livable cities today. And coming in at number four, we have an Australian city that I know rather well. It's my old hometown of Melbourne. We sent the always thirsty Monocle contributor Stephen A. Russell along for a drink with Maz Salt, founder of the design-led entrepreneurial outfit The Office of Public Works. And he's also the owner of some of Melbourne's best bars, including Laneway Pioneer Section 8, Belleville's more recent addition to Chinatown, Ferdy Dirk, and B East. Stephen and Maz spoke about the bar scene and maintaining Melbourne's reputation as the cultural capital of Australia. Stephen began by asking what it is about the city's famous Laneway bar scene that helps put Melbourne on the map.
I think the city of Melbourne can take a lot of responsibility for it, but obviously economic conditions have also played a huge part in the availability of space over the last 10 to 15 years as well. The city of Melbourne really was vacant 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I think that's always an opportunity for people like myself to come in and pick up space.
And how do you look at a car park and see a bar? You know, tell me a little bit about that thought process too.
It had a really nice tree. And that was probably the key feature. Other than that, it was a lot of soul searching and sitting and researching and thinking and having a beer or two in the car park and thinking about it. But primarily it's in Chinatown, which makes it such a local point for traffic. That really was a key part of its appeal.
Does it surprise you then, or do you think it's fairly well earned that Melbourne keeps getting this, you know, most livable city title over and over? And obviously now you are the owner of quite a few bars here. Does the bar scene play an element of why we're kind of seen as a cool place to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a huge array of complex factors that have gone into making the bar scene work that we can't take credit for it alone, although, you know, but definitely a large part of it. That is community radio stations, the education institutes, the legislative powers, the statutory authorities, landlords, and of course the public who come and drink.
And over the years, you've been quite a public defender of live performance in the city. I think you had a fashion show here last night. Tell me a little bit about the element of performance as well as part of what makes a city cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, bar industry is primarily about spectacle, and people are heading out to enjoy themselves and be separated from day-to-day grind, and a bar is a great place to enjoy that spectacle, and that can include fashion shows and circus performers. Melburnians are certainly very interested in participating in the latest and greatest of everything.
That was Stephen A. Russell there, lost in the laneways of Melbourne with Maz Salt. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Paris is a city in mourning this week after the death of one of its great institutions, the famous Le Huon Bookshop, which closed its doors for the very last time. Founded by a group of resistance fighters in 1949, it became a focal point for intellectuals far and wide. But falling turnover and rising rents have spelled the end for this Paris icon. Jeremy Mercer is a campaigner for independent bookstores. He joined Tige Enright on The Globalist earlier this week.
Just describe for us, if you will, how great a loss this is for the city of Paris.
I mean, I hate to be a contrarian, but I don't think it's that great of a loss, to be quite honest. Do you know those zombie movies where, say, a zombie bites your wife?
Indeed.
Yes, right. And then it's your wife, but it's also a zombie. So you're sad if that zombie's killed, but you're sad for what your wife once was. You're not sad that the zombie's dead.
So are you saying this has been a zombie bookshop for quite some time, eating brains and the like?
About 5 years. So you're absolutely right. I mean, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, this place was sensational, avant-garde. It was one of the first gallery bookstores in the world. Great artists went there. When I first moved to Paris, I went there to pay tribute. But the guy who started it, a wacky guy named Bernard Guibrand, he died in 2010. And since then, the bookstore is owned by Gallimard, which is a 500 million euro a year business. They moved from the old shop to a new shop. So it's a cultural institution as opposed to an avant-garde bookstore. It had a very wealthy clientele. It was doing nothing that was, say, pushing the boundaries of literature. And nobody's losing their job because they're all corporate employees now, just being reassigned to other places within Gallimard. Or the Madrigal Group. So,
I mean, do you think, was it effectively killed off? Was this icon, what made this bookshop special, killed off when Gallimard took it over 5 years ago?
I believe it's one of these things that's happening in contemporary society where these cultural behemoths are plucking up icons, right? Cultural icons, and thinking they can use it as marketing, they can use it as a networking hub, and then they treat it like an actual business. I mean, you mentioned following revenues. Do you know how much Le Huon, it's an aspirated H, by the way, earned last year? 2.3 million euros. A lot of my friends who own bookstores, they've had a great year if they've cracked 100,000 euros, you know? So it is what it is. But I think it's important to remember that when these sort of things fall, out of the ashes rise other great things. I mean, I think even you're a great example of that at Monocle, right? You're non-traditional media. Everyone's talking about, oh, the media crisis, newspapers are failing, traditional media is failing, but there's fantastic things happening. And what's happening here is a bookstore at the wealthy, elite left bank of Paris, a neighborhood that's not lacking for culture, cultural opportunities, loses an elite bookstore. So I'm sort of...
You don't sound very sad, Jeremy.
No, I'm not. Well, in 2014, 80 bookstores closed in France, and about 60 of those make me really, really sad. This one... Honestly, I think the founder of Le Huon would be smiling today, like a sad smile. You know that pouring one out for your dead friend? He'd be like, you had a good run, you went corporate, and you died.
That was Jeremy Mercer there in conversation with Tige Enright in a highlight from The Globalist on Wednesday. You're listening to The Recap here on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. And it's time now for a highlight from The Monocle Daily. Hong Kong is proving a rather tough nut to crack when it comes to Beijing's plans to shape its political future. The initial proposal to alter the way Hong Kong's leaders are chosen led to lengthy and widespread protests in a city hitherto not known for expressions of political frustration. And then the legislature voted against the plans. Some of the 28 out of the 70 members who cast a no vote, which needed two-thirds majority to pass, called Beijing's reforms a sham. But where does this leave Hong Kong, and indeed the Chinese Communist Party on the mainland, who will no doubt be contemplating a much longer game? Roderick Wai is the Associate Fellow of the Asia Program at Chatham House, and he joined Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller in the studio here at Midori House on Thursday.
It's kind of a strange defeat for the proposals because of this weird quirk that it needed a two-thirds majority to pass, because normally if 28 out of 70 people vote against you, you're comfortably over the line.
That's the rules in the Legislative Council, and that was always how it was going to be, that you needed a two-thirds majority for a fundamental change like this. The strange thing was that somehow the people who were expected to vote for the motion had marched out of the room.
Do we know why they'd marched out of the room?
There seems to have been some mix-up. I mean, that seems to me to be the most likely explanation. I mean, some people are suggesting that it might have been because they couldn't bear to vote for, but I think that is very far-fetched. Something, some horrible miscalculation went wrong. They thought that they had time to march out and have a cup of coffee or whatever it was they were doing, and they didn't. The voting was going ahead and went ahead. And so there was this remarkable situation where actually the no votes got the majority of those present in the legislative chamber.
Goodness me, so a situation and a place which is so well known for being rather well organised and for doing things on time and en masse suddenly finds itself in a completely different situation, all down to what you say, either, you know, a cup of coffee or answering the call of nature or a fire drill.
I mean, the fact that they did not vote actually didn't change the outcome, because the 28 who voted against were enough to block it. So there's a lot of red faces about the place, no doubt, but it didn't actually substantially change the outcome.
Roderick Wire there, in conversation with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller on Thursday's edition of the Monocle Daily. Well, that nearly brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Recap, but to finish things off, I think it's about time we turned our attention to the swirling shark pool of US politics and its fictional president, Frank Underwood. As we heard earlier in the show, the early days of politics on screen were filled with political agendas and propaganda. But as audiences matured to a new medium, so too did their expectations. In today's world, politics on screen is usually a place filled with cynicism, wry humour, and ulterior motives. And as I determined when chatting to film critic Tara Judah, dark scepticism can indeed take many forms.
I think what's really interesting is you have two really different shows with House of Cards and Veep. And so what's really intriguing about the kind of divergences they take is that House of Cards is, well, first of all, it's kind of a remake sprung from the idea of a 1998 BBC miniseries. So this is a kind of political thriller that has its traditions in genre work and follows something a little bit like The West Wing. It's got that kind of continual arc. So this is one of those TV shows that really takes you on a seasonal journey, and you're really invested in the characters and the developments and the way in which the plot and the intrigue is interwoven. What Veep does is really different. This is a sitcom, essentially, which has that sitcom setup of each episode is complete in and of itself. So the team around Selena Meyer, played by Julie Louis-Dreyfus, kind of make mistakes every single episode and everything resets at the end. So they're on this continual journey, and I think we're seeing something a bit different with season four as they're trying to make their way kind of continually into a higher position in the White House. But we see this kind of comical resetting. And I think the reason that's so fascinating now is because we're seeing this kind of new representation of politics as something almost Kafkaesque. One of the things that House of Cards does to show us this kind of new way of looking at this is by having the main character that Kevin Spacey plays, Frank, talk directly to the camera. So we get these asides, which I guess the writer's way of explaining to us that we're in on the joke, that we know, we're already savvy, we've seen so much of this political content on our screen. So we have gotten to a point where we are aware of a lot of the kind of operational devices that politics use. And in that sense, it's almost as if the audience are really invited to enjoy it on a much closer level.
That brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by me, Ben Rylan, and edited by Nina Norick. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, thank you for listening and enjoy your weekend.